The first is number 20-1958, Wolf v. McDonough. Mr. Bruskin.
May it please the Court, this is an appeal from a decision of the Veterans Court granting a petition for a writ of mandamus and certifying a class. The Court made multiple errors as highlighted in our briefs, but I'd like to discuss two today, Your Honors. First, Ms. Wolf had adequate alternative means to obtain the relief she was seeking by continuing the Title 38 process, obtaining a board decision, and appealing it to the Veterans Court. And second, the Court, although it recognized that the All Writs Act cannot expand its jurisdiction, it directly reviewed VA's rulemaking, which is a function that Congress vested exclusively in this Court in Section 502. On the first point, Title 38 provides veterans like Ms. Wolf with multiple avenues of administrative remedies and judicial review.
The Staub case not binding on the government in this case is a matter of collateral estoppel, right?
It is not on collateral estoppel. No, the Staub decision addressed the criteria for eligibility for payments under Section 1725. It did not interpret or address 1725 C4D.
It wouldn't make any difference if it had, would it? I mean, as I understand the Veterans Court, they're saying, yes, the Staub decision resolved this issue. Let's assume that they're right about that, but that still wouldn't be binding on the government, right?
No, I mean, the government can be...
It's binding in that case, but it's not binding in future cases.
Well, if it's a precedential decision, then it can have binding effect.
What about this court?
What's that? Not on this court. No, Your Honor, of course not.
I thought...
No, not this court. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. No, it doesn't have binding effect on this court. You're correct, Your Honor.
Or on the government, because you're entitled to litigate the issue that you lost in the Staub case in another case, right?
Right. I mean, the court, if it had simply waited for the board decision, could have invalidated VA's regulation based, if it wanted to, on its reasoning in Staub. But it viewed the VA's regulation as somehow evading the determination made in Staub. But Staub only talked about the criteria for eligibility. It did not talk about the payment regulation. So it did not decide the issues that VA was left to deal with following the Staub decision. This court in Lamb and Newman and others have opined that unless there's no meaningful avenue of review, mandamus is not appropriate. Lamb is particularly important because it talked about the adequacy of the Title 38 processes.
Counselor, I'm interested in this question about whether there's an adequate alternative remedy. If we find that, if we take a particular decision, it's going to just result in a useless exercise, meaning that the issue is going to come back to us. The very issue that is squarely planted in this court is going to come back to us. Then how would we say that that's an adequate remedy?
Well, it would be, the question is, aside from mandamus, is what's available to her adequate for Ms. Wolf to obtain her relief? If she had waited for the board decision and appealed to the Veterans Court could have reviewed the regulation in an as-applied challenge. But on the question of uselessness, Your Honor, I have several responses to that. As we note in our brief, it would not have been useless for the board to address the questions in this case first and to build a record of the proceedings. The 7252B requires the Veterans Court to make decisions on veterans cases on the record before the board. Congress in Section 511A said it wanted the Secretary and the board to make determinations of questions of law. In fact, even though the board is not able to overturn a regulation. So just on the question of whether it's useful.
What would happen then? The board cannot overturn its own regulation. So in my crystal ball, I see the issue going up to the Veterans Court. And then after that, what's going to happen? The issue's going to come up to us.
If it's appealed, but it might not, Your Honor. The decision may not be appealed by either side. So it wouldn't necessarily come here. Of course, as we note in our brief, Ms. Wolf has Section 502 as an adequate means in addition to following her case through the Title 38 process, because she could today file a challenge to the VA regulation in this court and get direct review by this court.
So just to clarify, it's your position that a 502 action could be filed now?
Yes, the regulation she's challenging was promulgated in 2018 or 19, I believe, and so it's within the six-year time frame for such a challenge. So it could be filed this afternoon, Your Honor. The other issue with futility, and there's two questions, two additional points I'd like to make. The first is that
there wouldn't be any problem with addressing the validity of the regulation in an individual benefits case, right?
Correct. There would not be. The Veterans Court in 7261 is empowered.
So she has basically two routes here, either to bring a 502 challenge in this court or to raise that issue in her individual case.
Correct.
You're just saying 502 prevents mandamus.
502 prevents mandamus for several reasons here. One is it is one of the adequate avenues she had for relief. So under the Cheney test for mandamus, she doesn't satisfy it. The other is that Congress gave this court exclusive jurisdiction to review rulemaking in 502. By granting the writ here, the Veterans Court directly reviewed VA's regulation. That is not within its jurisdiction.
But it was an individual case, right?
True, but it's not a direct challenge if it's an in individual case. It's an as-applied challenge based on the record of proceedings before the board. And 7261 powers are triggered by a final board decision under 7252A, which requires a board decision to reach the Veterans Court to mount an as-applied challenge. And that was going to be the other point I made on the uselessness question, is that 7252A is a jurisdiction requirement for a board decision to reach the Veterans Court. And so it is not subject to waiver for futility or a waiver of administrative exhaustion.
What about the All Writs Act, which states that the court can enter writs in cases in which it would aid their jurisdiction?
Sure. So there is the notion, limited notion, of prospective or potential jurisdiction where there's a plausible claim that something is preventing the petitioner from reaching the Court of Appeals. Here, Ms. Wolf did not allege that she was being prevented from obtaining a board decision for appeal to the Veterans Court. In her petition, she told the Veterans Court she was continuing to pursue her relief at the board, and all she needed to do was wait and obtain that board decision, and she could have appealed to the Veterans Court. So yes, there are limited situations where a prospective jurisdiction can provide a court the ability to reach down below a jurisdictional requirement, but only if it is the writ is in aid of actually exercising jurisdiction at some point.
If we were to agree with you that there were no alternative avenues for relief available, what would the agency's position be on remand?
On remand?
Well, I assume that if we were to say that the petition was improvidently granted,
correct,
that then the case would go back down to the board?
Yes. I mean, if the court vacated the writ here, it would also dissolve the class, and it would go back down to the board to re-adjudicate in light of the court's decision. And then she would get a decision that she could appeal to the Veterans Court. The Veterans Court would have a record of the proceedings, as Congress intended, and it could review the regulation apply in an as-applied challenge.
If that's the case, then why aren't we back to this being a useless exercise?
Because it's not useless. Congress designed the system so that the Veterans Court only had the power to conduct as-applied regulatory review based on the record of proceedings before the board. And what we see here is the practical problem with what the court did instead. If she filed a 502 challenge, there'd be an administrative record, right? Circuit Rule 15 governs administrative records. If she raised this in a proper as-applied challenge, there'd be a record of proceedings which the court is required to review under 7252B. The Veterans Court has rules for that, Rule 10 and 28.1. There are no rules for it to review regulations directly where it hasn't yet been applied by the board in that case. And so what we have here, you'll see it in the record, is the Veterans Court issuing order after order to the VA because it has questions, because it doesn't know the record. It doesn't know what supports this regulation because it was outside the bounds of the statutory scheme in conducting a direct regulatory review.
Counsel, in response to that prior question that I asked about what would happen if we were to send the case back or vacate the writ, what about the fact that the board already issued a decision in Ms. Wolf's favor?
That is a difficult question. I'm not sure what the board would do in that circumstance, because that board decision should not have issued because her case is still on appeal. So to be honest, I don't know exactly how the board would deal with Ms. Wolf's case itself. So I don't have a direct answer to that. I think the board probably hasn't been put in that situation frequently, so I'm not sure the board would even necessarily know exactly how it would proceed in that case. But for other veterans whose claims have not yet been adjudicated, obviously the adjudication will stop to evaluate the decision here and then move forward. There is also the situation where the Veterans Court has continued to require the VA to implement the writ, and so the VA has continued to pay money out to veterans under the strictures of the writ. So there are a lot of complicated issues that will come about because of the way the Veterans Court went about enforcing its writ and preventing the VA from appealing to this court for 7 months following the issuance of the order.
Could we talk for a minute about the regulations construction of the statute? Are you familiar with the legislative history of this provision of the statute?
Of the 17C4D, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Generally, yes, Your Honor.
But my understanding is that at the hearings on the bill, the VA, having originally objected to another version of the bill, took the position that what this exception applied to was co-payments and deductibles without any mention of co-insurance. And why shouldn't we look to that as an interpretation or as legislative history helping us to understand what the statute means? In other words, that the statute covers co-payments and similar payments, and that the similar payments are deductibles and not co-insurance.
Well, even if the court were to do that, the writ here would still need to be
reversed. No. I'm past that. I'm asking about the correct construction of the statute. And it strikes me, perhaps, that both sides are wrong about this, that your construction means that partial coverage is sufficient to defeat reimbursement. Their position is that the word similar payments has no meaning. It's limited only to co-payments. Why isn't there a correct middle ground based on the legislative history that co-payments and deductibles fall within the exception, but that co-insurance does not?
Your Honor, I won't object to the notion that that is a reasonable reading of the statutory language. And in fact, VA's regulation from 2012 precluded reimbursement of copayments and deductibles. In 2018, the VA explained it was clarifying that in its view, it had also always considered coinsurance to be similar, but it had not put it into the regulatory language. So Your Honor is absolutely correct. There is a valid ground for arguing that the similar language should cover only deductibles and not coinsurance. That is a reasonable reading, as we contend is the VA's reading, as perhaps is the petitioner's reading. The problem is that a mandamus, they had to prove that it was clearly and indisputably invalid as to both coinsurance and deductibles. And so even accepting Your Honor's reading of the statute, the Veterans Court erred in throwing out the entire regulation as it pertained to deductibles as well. And as Judge Falvey noted in dissent, even if the court did not believe that VA's regulation would survive a 502 arbitrary and capricious challenge, that does not mean it is clearly and indisputably invalid so as to justify mandamus. The court simply needed to wait for Ms. Wolf to obtain a decision, or some other veteran to obtain a decision.
Can I ask you something? You say clearly and indisputably invalid. Is it more clearly and indisputably that the agency's interpretation is unreasonable? Is that the inquiry? Because it's under Chevron Step 2, right?
Sure, yes. It could be, yes. But the standard is higher, right? It has to be clear and indisputable, not just simply is it unreasonable in the court's
view. I said clearly and indisputably unreasonable.
Unreasonable. Invalid for unreasonableness, sure, Your Honor.
Right.
But
well,
that's not just a Step 2 Chevron question. There's an argument that this can be resolved at Step 1 of Chevron as a construction of the statute itself, right?
That's true. And we did not ask for deference to the agency's interpretation in this case. We don't believe
But that is how the court below interpreted it, right? I read the Veterans Court's decision as saying we're going to move to Chevron Step 2, and that's how it was evaluated.
It did. I mean, the court did not linger long on the language of the statute. It jumped sort of directly to what it viewed was wrong with the regulation and assumed ambiguity. And as we noted, it did not really address in depth the similar payment language. It also did not at all address the other parts of 1725 that give VA the responsibility for determining the criteria for eligibility and limiting the amount of payment. So you're right, Your Honor. We are not making a Chevron Step 2 argument at this point, but on Chevron Step 1, our position is there are various reasonable readings of the statutory language. It's clearly not defined in the statute. And in that circumstance, there is no clear and indisputable proof that the regulation needs to be invalidated. I see I'm over my time, unless the court has further questions.
I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Griffin.
May it please the court, Sean Griffin for the petitioner appellees. Your Honor, I'd like to start.
So you say on page 10 of your brief, referring to the Staub case, you say that holding has been binding on the VA from the date of the decision. That is simply not correct. There is no affirmative collateral estoppel against the government under the Supreme Court's decision in Mendoza. The Staub case is not binding on the government in any case other than Staub, right?
I believe that in the Veterans Court, that it is binding as a precedential decision.
Well,
I concur with what you're saying, that it is not estoppel, and it's not binding in this court.
Okay, and the Veterans Court order seems to tell the government that they have to comply with Staub right away, that they have no ability to appeal that or challenge it in this individual case. I mean, surely they do have the right. Even though they decided not to appeal in Staub, they can appeal in this case from a decision of the Veterans Court saying that this statute excludes deductibles and coinsurance and get a decision from us, right?
I agree that this appeal is properly before the court, and I agree that the government has the right to try and argue that the new regulation, the interim rule, is valid. However, there is a relationship between that interim rule and Staub that I think was important and was motivating the court below.
Well, maybe so, but even so, I mean, even if it were a direct decision, if Staub would have been a direct decision about the regulations that it was invalid, the government doesn't have to accept that. They can litigate in another case whether that's a correct decision. And the problem with the mandamus here is it seems to bar the government from doing that. How can that be appropriate?
I disagree, Your Honor, because of what Staub ordered. What Staub ordered was that the rule that the VA was using to deny claims was invalid as a matter of law, and it struck it down. It held it unlawful and set it aside in the language of the statute, just like the APA. And then they did an appeal. Once they abandoned their appeal, that regulation is dead.
I don't understand why that's true. I mean, that was an individual case, and yes, they're bound in the individual case, but I fail to see how it can be that the government is bound in a subsequent case if it chooses to relitigate the issue.
But if the rule itself has been struck down, if it's been held unlawful and set aside, as is proper under 7261, the regulation is no longer law. The regulation is no longer available to provide a rule of decision in any case.
I think that's not correct. I think that the government has the right to relitigate any question in a subsequent case as long as there's an ability to appeal to this court.
Your Honor, I believe that when they failed to appeal Staub, I would draw an analogy to an APA challenge in a regular district court. If a district court strikes down a rule...
Well, that wasn't an APA challenge.
Yes, but the power under 7261 to hold unlawful and set aside was modeled after the APA and is...
I understand your position.
Okay.
Why don't you move on?
Sure. I'd like to talk about clearly and indisputable to pivot off of what the government was saying a second ago. Our position, and I believe the Supreme Court's position in Mallard v. District Court, is that clear and indisputable is judged after the court has determined what the law is. Right? So for this court to decide whether or not there's a clear and indisputable right to the writ, which is the phrase, they first have to decide what the underlying law is. In Mallard, the court actually used mandamus to resolve a circuit split. There was an active circuit split as to whether or not a district court could compel an attorney to perform as pro bono counsel. The question was clearly unresolved. The Supreme Court resolved it, and then they said that the attorney had a clear and indisputable right as we decide the law today. And so what that teaches is that clear and indisputable really just does turn on the merits, which I would also notice how the government framed its opening brief.
But the merits are not all that clear, right?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it is fairly clear. 1725C4A is the command. When Congress passed the...
They're limiting similar payment to co-payment. You're saying it doesn't cover anything else. Why would the language of the statute say co-payment or similar payment if it didn't include more than co-payments?
I think there is one meaning that everyone agreed below that the phrase or similar payments has, and which is to cover co-payments by another name. So if a health insurer, instead of using the term co-payments on its explanation of benefits, says visit fee, that would be a similar payment that would not be reimbursable under C4D.
Is there any indication in the legislative history that was concerned about what was meant by co-payment?
I believe the only relevant legislative history is the one that you cited earlier today.
Yeah, which the VA said it covers co-payments and deductibles.
But I'm not sure that the VA's position is controlling. I think that is...
No, it's not controlling, but it surely bears on what Congress meant by the language.
Yes. I mean, the one thing that shows beyond question is that the current rule is not a valid application of C4D because it covers all three things. By covering all three things, they covered the waterfront. And there is no reimbursement under C4A. And this is a very clear point. The record has no evidence in it. There's no example of any payment ever being made under C4A in the 8 years or 9 years it was on the books before the writ. Between the ban that was struck down in Staub and the interim rule and the stay in between to make sure that no claims got processed in the gap, the VA successfully avoided making any payments under C4A ever.
Do you agree that the interpretation that Judge Dyke referred to earlier, where the exclusion would include co-payments and deductibles but not co-insurance, is reasonable?
I don't, Your Honor, because deductibles are such an important part and such a large part of veterans' liability when we're dealing with partially covered services. Co-payments are fixed and small.
Are deductibles fixed?
Sort of. They're a fixed amount, but they vary over time. So if you have an emergency event in January, your deductible is probably not yet exhausted, and you're going to be on the hook for the full thing. The same veteran happens to have an emergency in December. The deductible is probably gone, and it's all coinsurance. So there's sort of a symbiotic give and take between coinsurance and deductibles.
Well, presumably that deductible is going to be paid at some point, whether it's through dentist visits, regular doctor visits, or what have you. It would have to be paid at some point, whether it's in January or December, right? So if it's paid because of an emergency surgery in January, later on when other regular routine doctor visits occur, that deductible won't have to be paid because it would be paid already, right?
That's true, but payments in the regular course and the regular seeking of health care, going to the dentist, getting an annual physical, are both scheduled and under the veteran's control. The deductible for an emergency care is quite different because it comes out of nowhere. No one plans on going to the ER. No one plans on a heart attack.
But those are policy arguments, which, you're not relating that to the legislative history or the language of the statute. That's the problem.
Well, I mean, the question was whether or not the interpretation that...
Well, reasonable doesn't mean reasonable as a policy matter. Reasonable means reasonable in terms of the language and legislative history and construction of the statute. Is it a reasonable construction of the statute?
again, I think the effect of the construction has to be taken into effect. I do think that the rules of statutory interpretation for a statute like 1725 are slightly different because of the pro-veteran canon and the Supreme Court's decision in Henderson v. Shinseki, that we have to look at this in a way that's going to protect the veteran and, you know, exposing them to deductibles on an emergency basis is not, I think, consistent with that approach.
Can I ask you about alternative avenue for relief?
Please.
Could Ms. Wolf, do you agree that Ms. Wolf could have challenged the regulation in a 502 action before this court?
No.
Why not?
No, Your Honor. As a factual matter, in 2018, the statute of limitations was imposed by this court through a local rule and was limited to 60 days. That wasn't struck down until December of last year.
Right now, that's the law. She can still file, right?
So can now, yes, I agree with that. Could then, no, I don't agree with that. Because this interim final rule was published in January with immediate effect. The 60-day clock was ticking from the moment it hit the Federal Register, and there was no practical way for Ms. Wolf to figure out that her denial was even based on the IFR before the 60 days had run.
In your view, is that you have to view the alternative avenue for relief and the availability of it as at the time of the filing of the petition for writ of mandamus?
I think it's a consideration, Your Honor. I think the adequacy, though, is also relevant. And 502 or the board, neither of them can provide class protection. One of the most important parts of a class action is the fact that it tolls things as the date it's filed. That's American Pipe and the Supreme Court's cases about class action tolling. When the IFR came out, all claims had been stayed for 2 years. Nothing had happened since Staub. And then the VA immediately turned the engine back on and started pushing claims through as quickly as they could. That created a situation in which veterans, you know, Ms. Wolf and everyone were being harmed. They believed that they were being harmed by an interim rule that they couldn't challenge under 502 anymore because they had missed the opportunity based on the way the interim rule was published.
Why isn't raising the validity of the regulation in her individual case a remedy that's available to her?
Well, she did that, but in her individual case without waiting for a board decision. If she had to wait for a board decision, then it wouldn't be until 5 years and the class, there wouldn't be class action tolling, and all of the veterans whose claims had become final in that interim would either be harmed or would be forced to rely on equitable tolling. And so that is part of the adequacy of the relief and why if class actions and Monk v. Shulkin are going to be meaningful, they have to be available in situations, extraordinary ones, not all situations, but extraordinary ones where there is mass harm being perpetrated against veterans in the form of a rule that we don't think was validly promulgated.
You seem to be arguing now that mandamus is available because it would take her 5 years to get a board decision. Did you argue that in your brief in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. We definitely raised unreasonable delay as one of the reasons to talk about mandamus in our brief.
Okay.
We mentioned several others, though.
So mandamus would be available to force the board to render a decision, but you never asked for that, right?
That's also an important question because we disagree with the government's position about prospective jurisdiction. In our view, once prospective jurisdiction exists, the first preliminary step, which in this case is clearly met by an NOD, then the court has power, and the question of whether mandamus is appropriate isn't a jurisdictional one. It's one of the Cheney factors, and this court's cases like In re Google or In re Cray, and the law professor's briefs does a good job of laying that out. The government responds, no. Even where prospective jurisdiction exists, the only valid exercise is to clear an obstacle to review. They would limit it to delay or failure to act. And we think that's wrong, and I think the Supreme Court said that's wrong in Labai. In the Supreme Court decision in Labai, the party opposing mandamus had specifically said that mandamus must be reserved for cases where review would be frustrated. And the Supreme Court said no. They said so long as the Court of Appeals would have jurisdiction in these antitrust cases at some point, at some stage, mandamus is appropriate under appropriate circumstances. And they went to the traditional factors from there and found that the question was sufficiently important to address it on an interlocutory basis.
You're saying mandamus is available anytime there's an important issue?
Not anytime there's an important issue, but this court's cases do say, and the Supreme Court's...
When is it appropriate? I mean, if the importance is the test, when is it appropriate?
A basic and undecided question of law that is going to affect innumerable cases.
So anytime that's
the case. Is one of the traditional bases for mandamus. That's this court's decision in Wright Cray. That's the Supreme Court's decision in Schlagenhoff. That is one of the permissible uses of mandamus.
Even if there's another remedy.
Well, in Labai, there was another remedy. The issue in Labai was whether or not the trial was appropriately set before a special master.
I actually don't think that's the case, because if you went through the physical examination, you would lose.
I believe that's Schlagenhoff, Your Honor. Well,
but in Schlagenhoff,
that's Schlagenhoff.
Yeah, under those circumstances, going through the physical examination would itself be an injury, which couldn't be redressed after final.
I agree. I was referring to the Supreme Court's decision in Labai, which involved a decision by the district court to refer the case, actually two cases, to a special master for trial. And in that case, the parties could have gone through trial, objected to it, and if the court found that the special master was without power to try it, they would have vacated the trial.
The theory there was that it was beyond the court's authority to do that, right?
Well, it was an improper use of Rule 53.
Yeah.
What was the theory there? But that is remediable on appeal from final judgment. The same way improper venue cases are sometimes, and here I'm distinguishing not transfer cases, but improper venue cases. You can appeal that from final judgment, and this court has, with some regularity, In Re Cray and In Re ZTE are both examples. They have allowed those issues, clear and undecided issues, to be resolved through mandamus.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm over time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Mr. Preston, I'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to make just a few points in response to the other side's argument. The first is with respect to unreasonable delay. Ms. Wolf did not claim unreasonable delay in her case, nor could she. She had filed her NOD to challenge the regional office decision only 3 months before she sought mandamus. So she was not being unreasonably delayed by the VA. What she's trying to do is rely on...
What if it's prospective unreasonable delay? Based on history and statistics, I expect there's going to be an unreasonable delay.
No, Your Honor. This court has already said in a footnote in Martin that even in cases of unreasonable delay, you have to prove it on an individual case basis. You cannot rely on averages because that's speculative. And mandamus is not cannot be based on speculative or anticipated obstruction. It has to be proven obstruction. So that's the response on the unreasonable delay piece. My opposing counsel touched on what I think one of the issues underlying this case is the tension between the Veterans Court's power to aggregate claims in a class action and the statutory requirements that obtain in any case. For decades, this court and the Veterans Court have recognized that 7252A imposes a decision requirement before the Veterans Court can exercise jurisdiction over most issues, unreasonable delay being an exception. But since Monk, we've seen certain judges on the Veterans Court decide that 7252 is, in fact, not jurisdictional, and it can be waived. And this court is going to see, this is just the first in a series of cases that are resulting from the court's attempt to use its class action powers to overcome the limits of its jurisdiction as set forth in Title 38, by doing things like certifying classes here with claimants with final unappealable claims, or in a case that the court's going to hear soon, SCAR, capturing claimants who never even yet filed claims, so-called future. So there is an underlying tension here. How does the court fit its class powers in with statutory requirements? And as we note in our brief, the Rules Enabling Act requires that the court not use its power to aggregate claims to overstep the bounds of its jurisdiction or to ignore statutory requirements. And finally, on the question of prospective jurisdiction, it is true that In Re Tenet says if you have started the process, you are potentially within the jurisdiction of a court, but the All Writs Act requires the writ to be in aid of the court's actual exercise of jurisdiction. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to get to review the case, but the writ has to do something to make it more likely that it will do so. Here, Ms. Wolf's claim disproves that fact here. Because of the writ, the VA granted her claim. She had no need to go to the Veterans Court. So as Judge Falvey correctly noted, the writ here thwarted the court's exercise of jurisdiction. It didn't aid it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.